Chapter 16. The Structure of Power. The smell of roasted cassava drifts through the air as I step into the central plaza of a Taino village on the north coast of Hispaniola. It's early morning, but the sun is already high enough to cast sharp shadows across the meeting space. At the center sits the cacique, his wooden duho, the ceremonial seat carved with a squat, almost human form, gleaming from years of careful use. Around him, the Natainos stand in loose formation, spears and carved staffs in hand, while the Naborias, the common workers, watch from the edges. The Taino world was not chaotic, nor was it an unstructured collective. It was an ordered society, and power had a deliberate architecture. The cacique was not merely a figurehead. He was the axis upon which the community turned. Bartolomé de las Casas, who lived among the Taino in the early 1500s, described them with a mixture of admiration and nostalgia. "They have lords who are obeyed and served with as much reverence as though they were kings," he wrote, "and they rule with a gentleness that makes their people love them." The role of the cacique. The cacique's role encompassed governance, military leadership, spiritual authority, and the orchestration of daily life. He was the final arbiter in disputes, the organizer of communal hunts and fishing expeditions, and the custodian of land distribution. Land in Taino society was not privately owned, but assigned for use by families within the village. The cacique oversaw this allocation, ensuring that no family went without access to fertile soil or fishing grounds. The cacique's authority also extended into the spiritual realm. Ceremonies for the Zimis, the ancestral and nature spirits, could not be conducted without his presence. This reinforced his position as both a political leader and a sacred intermediary. Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo noted in Historia General y Natural de las Indias that the caciques had their own idol or figure that represented the soul of their lineage, and to it they made offerings before any great endeavor. The Natainos, the elite class. Below the cacique were the Natainos, the warrior nobility who functioned as the community's administrative arm. They were not simply soldiers. They acted as advisors, organizers of communal labor, and keepers of oral history. Their loyalty to the cacique was expected, but it was not blind. A wise leader consulted his Natainos before making major decisions. In wartime, Natainos commanded small units of warriors, often leading them in ambushes against rival cacicazgos or defending their home territory. In peacetime, they supervised the planting and harvesting of cassava, the construction of canis, family houses, and the maintenance of baitis, the ceremonial plazas used for games and gatherings. Ramon Payne, the Catalan friar sent by Columbus to learn Taino beliefs, recorded that Natainos were those who assist the chief in matters of war and peace, in judgment, and in the ordering of the people. The Naborias, the working class. The majority of the population were the Naborias, farmers, fishermen, hunters, and artisans. They formed the backbone of Taino society, producing the food and goods that sustained the community. While their position was lower in the hierarchy, they were not slaves in the European sense. Their service was tied to communal obligation, and they had rights within the community structure. Tasks were gendered but interdependent. Men cleared fields and fished in the ocean's shallows, while women tended gardens, processed cassava, and crafted pottery. Oviedo observed, "In their labors they are not oppressed, for the chiefs know that the welfare of all depends on the contentment of those who work the land." Matrilineal succession. Power among the Taino was inherited through the mother's line, a system known as matrilineal succession. If a cacique died, the title would pass not to his son, but to his sister's son. This ensured that the bloodline, as traced through women, remained unbroken and verifiable. This practice placed great importance on the status of women within elite families. Noble women were often mediators between rival caciques, and their marriages could forge political alliances. A cacique's sister could wield considerable influence, especially in succession disputes. De las Casas remarked on this system with some fascination. "It is not the son who inherits the dignity of his father, but the son of the sister, for in this way they are certain of the royal blood." Regional alliances. The Taino world was not a single, unified state but a network of regional chiefdoms, or cacicazgos, each ruled by its own cacique. On Hispaniola alone, there were at least five major cacicazgos: Marin, Magua, Maguana, Jaragua, and Higüey. Each could contain dozens of villages. Alliances between these cacicazgos were often sealed through marriage, shared religious ceremonies, or mutual defense agreements. In times of threat, whether from Carib raiders or inter-island rivalries, caciques could rally hundreds of warriors by calling upon allied leaders. Still, these alliances were fragile. Rivalries could flare into war over fishing rights, trade disputes, or even insults delivered during ceremonial ball games. Daily governance. Daily governance was both practical and ceremonial. A cacique would often hold council in the morning, seated on his duho in the Beatty, with Netanos standing beside him. Disputes were heard, resource needs discussed, and decisions announced publicly. Ceremonies to honor Zimis were woven into governance. If a village suffered poor fishing or a failed harvest, the cacique was expected to lead rituals asking for divine intervention. Failure to maintain harmony between the people and the spirit world could weaken his authority. Gifts and tribute flowed upward. Baskets of cassava bread, fish, cotton cloth, and crafted items. But these were redistributed during feasts and ceremonies. This redistribution reinforced the cacique's role as provider. Oviedo noted, "The cacique receives tribute not to hoard it, but to give it in such a way that all may remember his generosity. Power, responsibility, and fragility. While the cacique's authority was strong, it was not absolute. A leader who failed to protect his people in war, neglected their needs, or angered the Zimis could see his position challenged. Netanos might withdraw support, and rival chiefs could entice villages to defect. It was this delicate balance of power, spirituality, and generosity that sustained Taino leadership for centuries before the arrival of Europeans. But the introduction of foreign diseases, weapons, and politics disrupted this system, eroding the authority of caciques and unraveling the intricate web of alliances. Standing in that imagined plaza, hearing the murmur of Naborias and the quiet authority of the cacique's voice, I can almost feel the stability of this order and the fragility that lay beneath it. The spirit world. The night is warm, the sky a deep indigo scattered with stars, and the only light in the village comes from the flickering glow of a fire at the center of the Beatty. Shadows stretch and sway as the people gather in a semicircle, their faces reflecting the flames. At the head of the gathering sits the cacique, a carved Zimi placed before him on a small platform. This is not a casual meeting. It is a ritual, one that binds the living to the unseen forces that govern the world. For the Taino, the spiritual realm was not an abstract belief, but a reality as tangible as the soil beneath their feet. The spirit world was woven into every decision, every harvest, every voyage into the open sea. The Zimis, sacred intermediaries. Central to Taino spirituality were the Zimis, sacred objects that embodied deities, ancestor spirits, or forces of nature. They could be carved from wood, stone, or bone, or even represented through natural objects like oddly shaped roots. Ramon Payne, who lived among the Taino in the 1490s, wrote in relation a Cerca de las Antigüedades de los Indios. These images, which they call semi, they keep in great reverence, believing them to have power to give them rain or sunshine, and to make their crops grow. Zimis were not passive icons. They were treated as living beings, fed with offerings of cassava bread, bathed in water, and consulted in times of uncertainty. Their power could be benevolent or wrathful, depending on how they were honored. Some Zimis represented Yukahu, the spirit of cassava and the sea, provider of food and fertility. Others embodied Atabe, the mother of waters and goddess of fertility. Still others were tied to individual ancestors who continued to guide and protect their descendants. Cohoba, speaking with the spirits. One of the most powerful rituals for communicating with Zimis was the Cohoba ceremony. Using a forked wooden inhaler, spiritual leaders and caciques would breathe in the ground seeds of the Anadenanthera peregrina tree, a potent hallucinogen. Bartolomé de las Casas described the practice vividly. They take a certain powder through the nose which makes them lose consciousness, and in that state they speak with the semi, hearing what it wills to tell them. Under the influence of Cohoba, visions were seen as direct messages from the spirit world. Guidance on planting, fishing, or warfare might be received in this way. The ritual also served to reaffirm the spiritual authority of the cacique, who was often both political leader and medium between his people and the divine. Mythology and the cosmic order. Taino mythology explained the origin of the world, the balance of nature, and the relationship between humans and the supernatural. In one of the most well-known creation stories recorded by Payne, humanity emerged from a cave called Casabajagua, while the sun and moon were born from another cave, Iguanaboyna. The people who failed to return to the cave before dawn were turned into trees, rocks, and animals, a reminder of the thin boundary between human and nature. The spirit of the dead traveled to Kobe, the land of the ancestors, a peaceful realm ruled by Makatori Guayaba, the lord of the dead. Here, the deceased lived much as they had in life, fishing and eating cassava, free from hunger or pain. Nature itself was animated by spirits. The wind had a personality, rivers could be angered, and storms were the wrath of Guabancex, the fierce goddess of hurricanes. Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo noted that the Taino treated storms as a spiritual as well as natural event. They believe the winds are the anger of a woman spirit, and they placate her with dances and gifts so that she will pass them by. Ritual life and community. Spiritual practices were not confined to elites. Every member of the community took part in seasonal rituals, planting festivals, harvest celebrations, and ceremonies marking the arrival of the rainy season. Music and dance were essential, with maracas, drums, and flutes used to create rhythms that carried the prayers of the people. The Beatí, which served as a political council space, was also a sacred ground. Ceremonial ball games were played not only for recreation, but as offerings to the Zimis. Victory could be seen as a sign of divine favor. The connection between spirituality and daily life was so strong that no major action, from clearing a field to launching a canoe, occurred without first seeking the blessing of the spirits. Spiritual specialists. While the cacique often led rituals, the Behique, the shaman or healer, was the specialist in the spirit world. Behiques interpreted dreams, diagnosed illness, and prescribed herbal remedies. They were also the custodians of myth and oral history, ensuring that stories of the Zimis and the ancestors were passed down accurately. A skilled Behique could enhance a cacique's authority by confirming his visions and decisions as aligned with the will of the Zimis. Conversely, a Behique who questioned a leader's spiritual standing could undermine his legitimacy. The coming disruption. When Europeans arrived, they were quick to recognize the central role of Taino spirituality in uniting communities. Missionaries like de las Casas sought to replace the worship of Zimis with Christianity, often destroying sacred objects. De las Casas himself, despite his sympathy for the Taino, admitted to removing Zimis, saying, "We took from them those figures in which they placed their faith, showing them that there is only one God, creator of all." This campaign, combined with disease, war, and forced labor, deeply fractured the spiritual fabric of Taino society. The loss of Zimis was more than religious. It was a blow to political authority, cultural identity, and the sense of cosmic order that had guided them for generations. Yet traces of the old beliefs endured. Elements of Taino spirituality blended into Afro-Caribbean traditions, surviving in folk stories, rituals, and even in the names of winds and places. The final days. The sea was the first to tell the story. From the shores of Hispaniola and Puerto Rico, Taino fishermen began to notice the horizon changing. Where there had once been only the blue expanse, now there were ships, immense wooden beasts with bellies full of men, sails swollen like the wings of giant seabirds. I imagine standing there beside them, the salt air heavy with unease. The elders speak in hushed voices, their eyes moving between the unfamiliar vessels and the Zimis resting in the shade of a ceiba tree. This was not the first arrival. By now, stories had already spread across the islands of pale-skinned strangers, of iron and thunder, of demands and diseases. But this time, the ships seemed endless, fracturing the cacicazgos. By the early 1500s, the intricate network of Taino political power, caciques, Natainos, and the alliances that had taken generations to build, began to fracture. Some leaders sought to resist the Spanish outright, rallying warriors and calling upon Zimis for protection. Others, faced with overwhelming force, entered uneasy alliances, offering food, labor, or land in exchange for survival. Bartolomé de las Casas described the impossible position many caciques found themselves in. They were lords, yet they had become servants. Those who commanded now obeyed, and their power was made as nothing. Regional alliances, once based on mutual trade and defense, were now strained. The Spanish inserted themselves into rivalries, exploiting old disputes to weaken resistance. Even matrilineal succession, the anchor of stability in Taino governance, was disrupted as heirs were killed in battle or taken as hostages. the spiritual war. The Spanish understood that breaking Taino-political unity also meant dismantling their spiritual backbone. Sacred zimis were seized, burned, or locked away. Behiques, once the voice of the spirit world, were silenced through imprisonment or execution. Without the rituals that bound the community together, morale faltered. Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo, unsympathetic to Taino beliefs, wrote bluntly, "We took from them their idols, for they were lies of the devil, and they resisted not, being already much reduced." For the Taino, this was not simply the loss of religion. It was the unraveling of their cosmic order. Crops failed without proper ceremonies. Illness spread without the guidance of the healers. And as epidemics of smallpox, measles, and influenza tore through the villages, the old balance between life and death was shattered. The final resistance. On Hispaniola, the resistance led by caciques like Enriquillo in the 1510s and 1520s offered one of the last organized challenges to Spanish rule. Enriquillo, educated in a monastery but steeped in Taino heritage, used both diplomacy and guerrilla warfare to protect his people in the Bajoruco Mountains. His defiance echoed the determination of earlier leaders like Cayanabo, who had attacked the Spanish fort of La Navidad, and Anacuona, the famed poet queen of Zaragoza, who refused submission and paid for it with her life. De las Casas remembered Anacuona with rare admiration. She was of great understanding, gracious in speech, and very prudent, and she ruled her people with justice and love. But such figures became fewer with each passing year. Absorption and survival. By the mid-16th century, much of the Taino population had been reduced through disease, forced labor, and warfare. Survivors were absorbed into the Spanish colonial system, often through intermarriage with Europeans or Africans brought as slaves. The distinct political structure of the Casicazgo dissolved, replaced by Spanish municipal governance. And yet, the Taino did not vanish entirely. In remote mountain valleys, fishing villages, and small farming communities, traditions endured quietly. Words like hammock, canoe, barbecue, and hurricane carried their language into global vocabulary. In music, in agricultural methods, and in the syncretic religions of the Caribbean, the memory of the Taino world remained, altered, but alive, standing in the silence. I walk now through what was once a thriving Taino plaza. The ceiba tree still stands, its roots gripping the earth as if holding onto the last threads of the old world. The air is heavy with the knowledge of all that was lost, but also with the truth that history is never fully erased. Beneath the soil, in artifacts, in songs, in bloodlines, the Taino remain. As De las Casas once wrote, reflecting on the people he had known in his youth, they were the most peaceable people in the world, gentle, without hatred or desire for revenge, and their memory should not be lost.